I've been talking about myth for the last 3 weeks, but I'm still left with a bit of a question. What has myth got to do with us? What does it really have to offer us here and now in the 21st century? So I've really been sharing what's been quite a live process for me. I've been really kind of looking at my attraction to myth, my draw to it, to imaginal practice in general, my understanding there's more to us than the rational mind and that we need to use myth to speak to the non-rational parts of us, and that it carries deep meaning, deep spiritual truth, myth. And I've said that, anyway, I think it's inevitable. Human beings do just create stories. And, yeah, just thought about myth in different ways. I was saying the first week that, quoting, that myth is an event which in some sense has happened once, but also happened all the time, happens all the time. It's sort of in a different way of thinking of time, really. And myth is true if it's effective, rather than being concerned with whether it actually happened. It's like, does it have an effect on you? It's really the point. So the last 2 weeks I introduced aspects of the vision of the Mahayana, and I was really questioning all the way with myself, what is it really trying to get at, and then trying to bring that out. What does it really do for me to engage with these myths? Because they can seem so foreign in a way, so culturally different and removed from us. But still, what can I really say it has to do with us now? So tonight I want to share a bit of an expansion of a map. I talked the first week about mythos and logos, these two ways of approaching things, these two ways of thinking about my poet and my scientist. And yeah, I've been thinking more about that today. And my thinking, well, I'm always indebted to Bhante, to Sangharakshita, who's shaped my thinking over more than two decades. But I've been thinking a lot, reading Karen Armstrong's Short History of Myth, which I quoted from a lot in week one, and also Yuval Harari's Homo Deus has got all sorts of fascinating things. I recommend that. It's a really good read. So I've kind of expanded my thinking, really drawing on them. So I'm going to just put a few things on the flip chart. So mythos is the realm of sort of traditional myth, myth and ritual, and religion. And it's really, and logos is the realm of reason, science, logos is concerned with the external world. And yeah, reason and science, and mythos is about meaning and purpose. So yeah, logos is the realm of objectivity, really, of the external world, of, you know, facts, what actually happened. And it's very powerful, it's very practical in that realm. it's had a lot of success in that realm. For example, we've, you know, practically eradicated plague and famine to a large extent, things that used to be huge problems for humanity. We've kind of dealt with through that way of approaching things. But it doesn't give us the meaning and purpose that traditional myth and religion did. So I've got a very long quote from Karen Armstrong about why this matters, what the difference is. What we've lost, really, in moving as a culture, largely from dwelling in the realm of mythos to the realm of logos, which I think is what's happened, which I talked a lot about the first week. So, Karen Armstrong says, mythical thinking and practice had helped people to face the prospect of extinction and nothingness and come through it with a degree of acceptance. Without this discipline, it has been difficult for many to avoid despair. The 20th century presented us with one nihilistic icon after another, and many of the extravagant hopes of modernity were shown to be false. The sinking of the Titanic in 1912 showed the frailty of technology. The First World War revealed that science, our friend, could also be applied with lethal effect to weaponry. Auschwitz, the Gulag, and Bosnia spelled out what could happen when all sense of sacredness is lost. We learned that a rational education did not redeem humanity from barbarism, and that a concentration camp could exist in the same vicinity as a great university. The explosion of the first atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki laid bare the germ of nihilistic self-destruction at the heart of modern culture. And the attack on the World Trade Center in 2001 showed that the benefits of modernity, technology, ease of travel, and global communications could be made instruments of terror. Logos has in many ways transformed our lives for the better, but this has not been an unmitigated triumph. Our demythologized world is very comfortable for many of us who are fortunate enough to live in first world countries, but it is not the earthly paradise predicted by Bacon and Locke. When we contemplate the dark epiphanies of the 20th century, we see that modern anxiety is not simply the result of self-indulgent neurosis. We are facing something unprecedented. Other societies saw death as a transition to other modes of being. They did not nurture simplistic and vulgar ideas of an afterlife, but devised rites and myths that helped people to face the unspeakable. In no other culture would anybody settle down in the middle of a rite of passage or an initiation with the horror unresolved. But this is what we have to do in the absence of a viable mythology. I found that quite strong reading. When you add in the sort of 21st century threats that we think we're facing now, it just really convinced me that we need positive myth. We need something to save us from this bleak despair of, yeah, just kind of hopeless nihilistic view of the world. I can't bear to live in an empty world that's not got anything more to it than what science, what logos, what reason can offer us. So that's really what I'm wondering this evening. Like, what could that be? What is the, you know, what is there to offer into this kind of void of meaning that we're facing in the 21st century? Because I don't think we can return down here to traditional belief. I don't think we can do that now. I think we're too sophisticated. I think we're too much in love with the power of logos. It's been too successful for us. It's too true for us. And traditional myths limit our individuality. All the authority, all the power is out there somewhere. They're all kind of resting with, you know, the cosmic creator or something, telling us what to do. So we want a lot more individual autonomy than that these days. So I don't think we're going to be willing to go back to anything less. But Harari says we've done a deal. We've given up meaning. We've given up belief in a grand cosmic plan in exchange for power, in exchange for the control we have over our world and for our, you know, individual autonomy. We've given up. We've done a deal. So where are we to find meaning, purpose, ethical guidance, authority in life? Where are we going to do that? Science has no answer to ethical questions. Religion can, but it often gets confused with whether it's making an ethical judgment or whether it's stating facts about life. So there's a whole sort of section in Harari's book about that, which is really interesting too. But in a way, only something other than science and reason can answer the ethical questions. And where are we going to find a worthwhile, meaningful, creative, positive myth that we can really go with today? Interestingly, Karen Armstrong suggests literature is what can provide us with the kind of empathic connection and kind of meaning and so on in life. Which made me think that Bante got there first, really. And all he's got an essay on the religion of art, and lots of, you know, he draws a lot on how we can draw on art and literature and so on in our culture. That's our kind of way into the imagination, into the world of myth and being moved. But it didn't really answer something for me to think that we were all going to kind of, you know, we're all reading different books, aren't we? And, you know, which books are really going to be the ones that are going to guide us, and how's that going to be? Yes, a great novel can have a big effect. It can shape people's thinking. It can become part of the mainstream. You know, we all know something about 1984 and what that stood for. We all know about Big Brother, and, you know, things can become part of the collective culture. But I wasn't very convinced that that was the answer that I was looking for. So I was talking to you about my poet and my scientist. So obviously my scientist is happy here. I also have in me a poet. And I was suggesting that developing, if you like, our poetic sensibility, our sort of sensitivity to myth would be the way to engage with it. That was how I was introducing in week one, the fact that we were going to go on and spend 2 weeks dwelling with myths from the Mahayana. I was saying, don't worry about it making sense to your rational mind. It's a different, non-intuitive, irrational or non-rational part of you that needs to engage. And that's something we need to condition, practice with, inform as well. So there's a sort of sensitivity here. So this, with the black pen, got it in front of me. This area is about our inner responses. We've got the kind of external objective world here and this inner subjective response to things going on here, this subjective sensitivity, the arena of feeling and emotion. Objective. It's all a bit slanty, I can't seem to write straight on the board. So Harari says that actually this inner subjective world of feeling is where our religion lies now. He says the main religion at the moment is humanism. There's a whole set of beliefs and values that we're all very guided by. So I think that fits with my poet over there. He says this is how we've managed with this deal where we've given up meaning in exchange for power, there's a kind of get-out clause which says if you can find meaning without it being part of a cosmic plan, then you can still have meaning. So he says from that we've looked to humans for meaning. We've looked to ourselves, to our inner world. So humanism really takes all authority and meaning from in us. I'll read you a quote from Harari about that and the effect it's had, because that's also lifting us from this traditional mythic world to something else. As the source of meaning and authority relocated from the sky to human feelings, the nature of the entire cosmos changed. The exterior universe, hitherto teeming with gods, muses, fairies, and ghouls, became empty space. The interior world, hitherto an insignificant enclave of crude passions, became deep and rich beyond measure. Angels and demons were transformed from real entities roaming the forests and deserts of the world into inner forces within our own psyche. Heaven and hell, too, ceased to be real places somewhere above the clouds and below the volcanoes, and were instead interpreted as internal mental states. You experience hell every time you ignite the fires of anger and hatred within your heart, and you enjoy heavenly bliss every time you forgive your enemies, repent your own misdeeds, and share your wealth with the poor. So that might sound like Buddhism, but it isn't. It isn't enough. Buddhism goes further than that. Harari's book actually shows the levelling effect that you get from thinking that, like, what we create from everyone's subjective experience being equally valid. There's a lack of higher values informing things. Okay, you haven't got God kind of informing you, but you haven't got anything more than what I think or you think, what I feel and you feel. So he shows the effect of that in art, where the motto becomes beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So yeah, there's something in that. The way I behold art makes a difference. But you know, it means that you get, well, he gives the example of a urinal in an art exhibition being hailed as a work of art. It's like, really? Is that really? You know, it's just not even trying to communicate higher value. It's saying, if I say it's art, and that's it. He shows the effect in economics, the whole kind of consumerist society, the customer is always right, what we've got to do is keep making what the consumers want, and all the damaging effects of that. In education, the motto is think for yourself rather than learn from the wise. In politics, you get the voter knows best, and we've kind of seen in recent elections where that goes. And in ethics, you get if it feels good, do it. That's, you know, the end of things. If it's what you know, feels good to you, that's the only guide. So it isn't enough. It isn't enough. I know for myself, I can't give full authority for my life to my poet, valuable though she is. It's really important that I give her life and space, almost counter the kind of prominence I've given to my scientist earlier in my life. It's really important that I really develop that sort of sensitivity in me. But I don't want a life that's all about me and my feelings and my sensitivity. It's not enough. And it's not something I can rely on. My poet brings beauty and meaning into my life, but she's very fickle. It's like I can't depend on being able to kind of move into that really sensitive space on any occasion, being able to feel responsive to the beauty of life. And if I look for my inner voice to guide me, well, that is an important thing to learn to do. I have, you know, developed that ability to learn what I can trust in myself more and more, but As Harari says, if you look inside, you might just as likely find either a kind of silence or a cacophony of conflicted voices. So that's often the case as well. I often have a cacophony of conflicted voices, or just a blank, really. So we need to learn to work with all that. We need to learn to work with the cacophony. We've all got the kind of internalised voices of our parents especially, but our teachers, our spiritual teachers even, things we've read and heard from friends or, just all sorts of, it should be this way, it should be that way, this is right and this is wrong. And you need to find a way to navigate that. So there is a sense of something deeper and truer that can come through. But it's kind of like not that easy to get to rely on that. And to learn to trust something deeper, I think we need to learn to trust each other. We need people who know us well, who we can trust will kind of pick us up if we're going too far off course. So we need to kind of open more and more to ourselves and our inner worlds, but to each other as well, to our friends in the Dharma. But mostly it's not enough for me to sort of just live in this subjective realm, because it's just too small and limited. I talked the other week about that image we use on the introductory course of the dungeon with all the snoozing kings and queens and bards and wizards and all these kind of characters down there in the cobwebs that we've got to speak to in mythic language to wake them up. Well, it needs to be kind of big mythic language as well. Just sort of, I feel like this isn't really going to, it's not going to move them. It's not going to wake them up. It's got to be something more. They need to be part of a really big cosmic happening. They want total transcendence of self and world, total transformation. They want something really worth waking up for. So the Dharma is about transcending subject and object, the inner world and the outer world, this apparent dichotomy between self and other, self and world, me in here, the world out there. That's a much more mysterious and exciting possibility, I think, than just dwelling in either, any of these three areas I've brought so far, traditional myth, logos, or the inner world of feelings. And I think we can only do that, we can only transcend in this way, we can only find another way together. We need to use imagination and myth, ritual, to wake up those sleepy characters in our unconscious, in our non-rational minds. But I can imagine all I like in the privacy of my heart-mind, and that will have some effect on me, but it only goes so far. I can't really take it seriously enough if it's not part of some big vision that other people share with me. It becomes just imagination, just myth, just my fantasy of something somehow. It doesn't quite have enough reality, enough life. So what myth is collective imagination. It's about shared stories that we all kind of sign up for, we all share, we all respond to. Particularly. So Harari talks a lot about what he calls intersubjective. So it's not just subjective, it's between subjects, intersubjective stories. Now I think this takes us into the area that Sangharakshita and Subhuti call suprapersonal. It's beyond the personal. It includes the personal, but it's something above and beyond. It's between people with their feelings, includes that, and it's more than all of that. So this is the area where I think we can find myth and ritual that can really work for us now in the 21st century. And I think this is how we can really have an effect in our troubled world, by being together in a myth. Sharing creative myths. They need to be myths which encourage individual growth and compassionate connection. Myths that really work for us, really meet what we're up against as individuals and in the world. And it's the source of our humanity to do this. It's the source of our real power as human beings, our real ability to have an effect. This is Harari again. Homo sapiens rule the world because we are the only animal that can cooperate flexibly in large numbers. We can create mass cooperation networks in which thousands and millions of complete strangers work together towards common goals. One on one, even 10 on 10, we humans are embarrassingly similar to chimpanzees. Any attempt to understand our unique role in the world by studying our brains, our bodies, or our family relations is doomed to failure. The real difference between us and chimpanzees is the mysterious glue that enables millions of humans to cooperate effectively. This mysterious glue is made of stories, not genes. We cooperate effectively with strangers because we believe in things like gods, nations, money, and human rights. Yet none of these things exists outside the stories that people invent and tell one another. There are no gods in the universe, no nations, no money, and no human rights, except in the common imagination of human beings. You can never convince a chimpanzee to give you a banana by promising him that after he dies, he will get limitless bananas in chimpanzee heaven. Only sapiens can believe such stories. This is why we rule the world and chimpanzees are locked up in zoos and research laboratories. So our intersubjective stories, he argues, give us the basis for cooperation, create our world, give us power in the world, for good and ill. You know, our notions of money or nations, they've got so much effect on how we live, for good and for ill. And I think the prevailing myths that we're all living with, mostly not very consciously, just don't give us enough to live by. Because I think we really need a transcendent vision. We need a connected ethical system. We need myths that work for us ethically. And I think the Dharma gives us that. The Dharma is so much more than just secular humanism, so much more than this subjective world that is what we're mostly presented with as a means to value and meaning. We can use the Dharma in a secular sort of way. We can use it as a set of practices to become better people, and that can be effective. That's all well and good. But what moves me is a big transcendental vision. And this is what the Mahayana myths are pointing to, as I've been trying to draw out over the last couple of weeks. I don't know how you've got on with them, those myths. They can be, as I was saying earlier, a bit too foreign, a bit too strange, too big even, too abstract. And we do need something we can use. So thinking about this, I was sort of like, yeah, and I don't know that we're all going to really respond to the same bit of myth in the Dharma, or, you know, I don't quite know what's going to be something we can really share and be united on. But we need something we can use. Something we can do collectively, something we can participate in together. Actually, the Sangha itself answers quite a lot of what we need, I think. In a way, it offers us a vision, a myth of perfect human relationship, which we'll never live up to. It gives us that kind of like, how would it be if we were all perfectly kind and generous and, you know, lovely with each other, appreciative and helpful all the time. How would that be? And we don't. But there's a, you know, an uplifting effect, an inspiring effect with the possibility. The Sangha can give us a motivation beyond ourselves, something beyond our self-interest, just the subjective kind of preference, what I feel like doing. You know, I might not feel like coming down here on a Tuesday night at 6 o'clock. Sometimes I feel very tired and don't necessarily want to, but I've said I'll do it, and you know, I know it makes sense and it's what I want to do at a deeper level. So even just being in a friendship can mean, you know, you'll do something because it's what your friend wants or needs, even if you're not quite, you know, sure about that yourself. It can give you that motivation to do something more. And friendship gives us these sort of checks and balances on us kind of going astray, just following our feelings, doing it because it feels good. Your friends, when they know you well and they share your aspirations, can soon tell you if you're going too far off course. And the Sangha gives us a way to catch something more. It gives us a way to catch the perfume of the Dharma, of the wordless wisdom of the Dharma, the inexpressible that I've been trying to hint at with these myths we've looked at in the last 2 weeks. But yeah, what is it? What are we going to use to carry this myth and bring us together? I think the world so needs it. It so needs meaning and purpose. And we really need it. We need something we can participate in together. So it needs to be something that's effective. A myth that works. It needs to be human, practical, livable. It needs to show us how to live. It needs to be ethical. It needs to be infused with compassion and respect for life. It needs to be not untrue. It's a carrying truth of a different nature. It needs to bring us closer to truth, actually. It needs to bring us closer to reality, closer to the way things really are. And it needs to be transcendent. It needs to take us beyond our experience into the unknown, into possibility, into what if. It needs to take us to this sense of the inconceivable, inexpressible, ungraspable, something more that lies beyond self-clinging. So I think our order gives us this myth. The Triratna Buddhist order provides this possibility. It's a glorious myth. There's no real legal entity to the order. It isn't really anything. It's a free association of individuals, a network of friends sharing a dharmic vision and aspirations. And we've caught that vision, that aspiration from Sangharakshita. That's what unites us in this order. As we get bigger, it's getting harder to hold that together. It's getting harder to share quite, or to agree quite, what it is we share. And we're starting to get more organised. It's sort of, we're needing more structures, more institutions than we used to, just because we, you know, it gets harder to communicate. You can't talk to the whole order at once now, it's got so big. When it was 300 people and you could get them in a room together from time to time, it was possible, but I think we're at 2,000 and something, I've lost track, but all around the world. So it's very hard to keep them all together. But those structures, those institutions aren't what the order is. They might be visible, but that's not what it's really about. What is it? What does make someone an order member? A dharmachari or dharmacharini. Dharmachari is the masculine, dharmacharini is the feminine. It means dharma farer, one who walks in the dharma, in the truth. So it's obviously not just about wearing a strip of white or gold cloth around your neck. It's not just about having a Sanskrit name. You know, you could make your own sort of strip of cloth and call yourself whatever you liked, really, and you know, that wouldn't really quite tick the boxes. It's something of a myth, of a vision, something we imagine together that makes the order what it is. It's not even just about trying to live good ethical lives, though we are. It's just, yeah, because of its myth that the order is deeply significant. Our names are given to us in recognition usually of our aspirations, and they're beautiful, meaningful names that are very significant to us. Mine's garlanded in flames. What are you, mind of wisdom? Tell me your name. Manjibhadra.
Yeah.
Gentle Thatra.
Gentle diamond.
Diamond. Gentle diamond. Isn't that beautiful? What does your name mean, Jonathan?
One who knows.
One who knows. He's deep, that one. And, yeah, and our kesa, our strip of cloth, marks our ordination. It's given to us when we're ordained, and I'll say a little bit more about that. But yeah, we're living a myth together. It's like we're like the Fellowship of the Ring, if you like. We're on a quest together, a band of fellows doing something important to us. Or one of my friends was saying that she thinks when we get together, it's a bit like, you know, the wizards coming together at Hogwarts or something. Most of the time we're living in this kind of muggle world where people don't know who we really are. But when we all get together, you know, something else happens. It comes alive. She also said, actually, it's different because in the Harry Potter stories, they're kind of fighting their own internal battles, or they're kind of, what they're dealing with is in their own world, whereas we're really trying to engage with the world beyond us as well. We're really trying to make a difference. And we are, we're offering something. The order, you know, each order member is offering something else to the world. We've got this picture on the shrine today of Avalokiteshvara, this bodhisattva of compassion who has 1,000 arms each. We're holding a different tool. And we often use that as a symbol of the order. We have one body, but we've got 1,000 arms, 2,000 or whatever it is now, each doing something different. So people are making a difference in the world, whatever they're doing. You know, doctors, teachers, social workers, artists, people, therapists, people leading retreats, people running Buddhist centres. In all sorts of ways, people are doing things that make a difference. We're all adding our bit into that stream of practice that I was describing, that the Mahayana sees us all engaging in, this stream of goodness. And you all are too. You're all here part of that stream, doing what you can just in how you live your life, how you interact with the people you meet. So yes, as order members, we've put ourselves into the myth of the order. And that is marked at our ordination particularly. The ordination follows from usually years of preparing for life in the order, of training, preparing. Years of deepening our understanding of the Dharma and deepening our understanding of what the order is and deepening our friendship with order members so that the network will be something real and lived, something real. And that process can be something of a hero's quest in itself. Most of us meet several of our demons along the way. We find out a lot about ourselves and, you know, yeah, it's a very fruitful time actually preparing for life in the order. And in a way, you're all already in the early stages of that quest. Perhaps you haven't yet decided to leave the Shire, your happy, homely hobbits pottering about, but you have at least met a few strange visitors to your world. You're here and you've met these wonderful wizards that we could pretend we are. You've met something. And we've dropped a few suggestions in. There are little sparks in you that you just don't know what they're going to lead to, what might flower from them. And some of you have definitely begun that journey. Some of you here have asked to be ordained and have begun this process of training. It's a training in confidence, really, a training in trusting yourself and each other and trusting the Dharma. Confidence in the order. based in Sangharakshita's vision, confidence in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in your ability to really follow that effectively. So eventually, once it's clear to you and to others that your vision of the Dharma and the order is confident enough and aligned enough with the order, and that you're able to really effectively do it, you're really able to follow through on your attraction to the three jewels and keep making the appropriate efforts to grow, once one is integrated enough to be able to really take responsibility for ethical choices and states of mind, once one has refined one's heart enough, with enough metta, enough faith to be able to launch into really unknown territory. Once you're able to commit to moving beyond self-clinging and really let in a bigger vision of what lies beyond that, that's when you could be invited to be ordained. The ordination happens on a special retreat, often one of several months long, 3 or 4 months long retreat, where you do lots of further preparation, lots of further purification, actually. And then there's the ritual at which ordination happens. So this is how we become wizards, is in this magical ritual, which is in two parts. So there's, first of all, the private ceremony, the private ordination, as it's called. And so this happens on a retreat, but you leave the shrine room, you leave the company of friends you've been journeying with, and go out to meet your private preceptor, the person who's going to witness your commitment to the three jewels. And that's what happens. It's a simple and profound ceremony. The person being ordained makes the three traditional offerings, just the same as we make at Mitra ceremonies, just the same as we might make anyway, a flower, a stick of incense, a candle. And you do various Pali verses, traditional verses, in which you're making a commitment. You're making a commitment to practicing the precepts as vows, and there are 10 precepts rather than the 5 that we normally chant, and to a particular meditation practice, often a contemplation of a Buddha figure, a deity who symbolises what lies beyond self-clinging for you, symbolises awakening, enlightenment for you. And you're given a new name to symbolise that you're moving into a new life symbolically, like it's a point that everything changes from. So this ceremony, the private ordination ceremony, particularly symbolises your willingness to really commit, even if you have to go it alone. You do it by yourself, saying that this is your real own inner volition, your own free choice, by yourself, and that's witnessed by your preceptor at that point. And then this ceremony is followed later on by what's called the public ordination ceremony, where everyone who's been ordained on that retreat, and there's usually several, have a ceremony together in which you're welcomed into the order. So this is a sort of real celebration, and that's when you're given a kesa. And your name is announced to the world. So it's like being, taken into the order. You find you don't have to do it alone. Surprise, surprise. Of course, you always knew there was an order you were joining. But this really, really symbolises your commitment to the order and to the world, particularly, I would say. It's a point at which everything changes and nothing changes. I went back to my life and 6 weeks later, I was kind of upset because everything was still the same as it had always been. I was still in my family doing my job and everything seemed much the same. But somehow, on that mythic level, there's like a depth charge is planted. And from then on, in that mythic realm, everything changes. The whole point of life turns around on that spot somehow. You know what you've promised to do when you're ordained. You know what that means. And although we all mess up and we go off course, you know what you need to come back to. I'm just going to read you some of the aspirations that we express in the ceremony in these lines of acceptance, because I think it gives a flavour of what we're committing to when we're ordained. So we say, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. They're big aspirations. For the sake of enlightenment, I'm going to live for the sake of enlightenment. What is that going to mean? They're like a bodhisattva vow. It's a commitment to what's currently impossible, what's currently unknown, what's currently beyond your small self, a commitment to move into something unknown and bigger and greater all the time, again and again. And it is an effective myth. It's effective, it works. Being in the order has given me a satisfying, meaningful life. It's given me a way to engage in ongoing transformation, becoming more and more fully myself. It's not like we become clones of each other, we become more and more who we are, most deeply, most fully somehow. It's given me more trust in myself and more trust in other people, more openness to myself and to other people. And it's given me a way to offer this all to the world. It's given me a way to offer what I think the world most desperately needs, this intersubjective, suprapersonal myth, this meaning and purpose to life. I think together we can offer, well, we do offer contexts in which people can glimpse the sacred. They can glimpse the more than. We're creating portals to the divine. And we offer a training in the holy life. We offer a system, practices, ways of doing that. There is a route, there's a path that we offer to anybody coming through the doors of this centre. And I see people change. I see my friends change. I see the people I meet in these classes changing through that contact, through those glimpses of the sacred, those glimpses of the divine. We're not a Mahayana school as such. We're our own tradition. The Triratna Buddhist community is its own vehicle, as I was saying 2 weeks ago, but it definitely lies within the Mahayana vision. We do see our practice as part of this cosmic stream that all life is part of, this stream of growth towards Buddhahood, this ultimate ever-expanding ideal of human potential and of love for all that lives, compassion, connection. And again, we each work to keep that vision alive against the tendency to literalise, to narrow down, to limit, to appropriate whatever we're doing to our own ends. It's so strong, that tendency to turn everything in on ourselves, what we need, what we want. And we're actually a pretty ordinary bunch. You know, we've got our Sanskrit names and our bits of cloth. But we've got often really messy processes of growth. We're often nowhere near that vision. We're nowhere near expressing our values and our ideals. We mess up all the time. We do all sorts of shameful things. But we aim to own it, admit it, confess it, let go, move on, come back to what we really, really want to do. And we have this extraordinary, mythic, aspirational vision to come back to. This vision of what our lives are really about. And that's what the order is. And it only exists to the extent we participate in it. It only exists if you show up, if you take part, if you do it. So, a paragraph from Sangharakshita, this much quoted paragraph from his paper with Subhuti, What is the Western Buddhist Order?, speaks to this. There is something about the movement, the order, and even about me, that's Sangharakshita, that is not easily definable. There is a touch of something that cannot be buttoned down. Something that cannot in the end be defined. Even the desire to button it down or define it is a mistake. That was the mistake that the Theravada made in connection with its Vinaya, its code of conduct. Everyone will need to take care of that rather mysterious, indefinable spirit that gives the movement life and energy. So all of us are part of the Triratna Buddhist community. We're all in touch with this mysterious, indefinable spirit. At times, we have that opportunity. It's what gives us life and energy as individuals, as a community. And we all need to take care of it by showing up, by remembering it, and by showing up for each other, showing up for the Buddhist Centre, showing up with our friends and with ourselves in our meditation practice. We just need to be there. This indefinable spirit is what the Triratna Buddhist Order, what the Triratna Buddhist community is. And it's what it offers you. Any of you could become an order member if you dared to set out on that quest, if you choose to accept that offer that we're making to you.